Track 1.
Monsoon by Wilbur Smith. I dedicate this book to my wife, Danielle Antoinette, whose love down all the years has been the monsoon wind that, constant and true, has given my life direction. The three boys came up through the gill behind the chapel, so that they were hidden from the big house and the stables. Tom, the eldest, led them, as he always did. But the youngest brother was close on his heels, and when Tom paused where the stream made its first turn above the village, he renewed his argument. "Why do I always have to be the cat? Why can I never join in the fun, Tom?" "Because you're the littlest," Tom told him with lordly authority. He was surveying the tiny hamlet below them, which was now visible in the slot of the ravine. Smoke was rising from the forge in the smithy, and washing flapped in the easterly breeze behind the Widow Evans' cottage. But there was no sign of human life. At this time of day, most of the men would be out in his father's fields, for the harvest was in full swing, while those women who were not toiling beside them would be at work in the big house. Tom grinned with satisfaction and anticipation. "No one spotted us. No one to carry reports back to their father." "It's not fair." Dorian was not so easily distracted from his argument. His coppery gold curls spilled down onto his forehead, giving him the look of an angry cherub. "You never let me do anything." "Who let you fly his hawk last week?" "I did," Tom rounded on him. "Who let you fire his musket yesterday?" "I did." "Who let you steer the cutter?" "Yes, but..." "But me no buts," Tom glowered at him. "Who's the captain of this crew, anyway?" "You are, Tom." Dorian dropped his green eyes under the force of his elder brother's stare. "But still..." "You can go with Tom in my place if you want." Guy spoke softly for the first time. "I'll play the cat." Tom turned to his younger twin, while Dorian exclaimed, "Can I, Guy? Will you really?" It was only when he smiled that his full beauty burst out, like sunlight through parting clouds. "No, he won't," Tom cut in. "Dorry's only a baby. He can't come. He'll stay on the roof to keep the cat." "I'm not a baby," Dorian protested furiously. "I'm nearly 11. "If you're not a baby, show us your ball hairs," Tom challenged him. Since he had sprouted his own, these had become Tom's yardstick of seniority. Dorian ignored him. He had not even a pale ginger fluff to match the impressive growth of his elder brother. He went on to another tack. "I'll just watch, that's all." "Yes, you'll watch from the roof," Tom killed the argument dead in its tracks. "Come on, we'll be late." He struck out up the steep ravine. The other two trailed after him with varying degrees of reluctance. "Who could come anyway?" Dorian persisted. "Everybody's busy. Even we should be helping." "Black Billy could come," Tom replied, without looking back. That name silenced even Dorian. Black Billy was the oldest Courtney son. His mother had been an Ethiopian princess whom Sir Hal Courtney had brought back from Africa when he returned from his first voyage to that mystic continent. A royal bride and a shipload of treasure plundered from the Dutch and the pagan, a vast fortune with which their father had more than doubled the acreage of his ancient estate, and in so doing had elevated the family to among the wealthiest in all Devon, rivaling even the Grenvilles. William Courtney, Black Billy to his younger half-brothers, was almost 24, 7 years older than the twins. He was clever, ruthless, handsome, in a dark wolf-like way, and his younger brothers feared and hated him with good reason. The threat of his name made Dorian shiver, and they climbed the last half mile in silence. At last they left the stream and approached the rim, pausing under the big oak where the hen harrier had nested last spring. Tom flopped down against the bole of the tree to catch his breath. "If this wind holds, we can go sailing in the morning," he announced, as he removed his cap and wiped his sweaty forehead with his sleeve. There was a mallard wing feather in his cap, taken from the first bird ever killed by his own falcon. He looked around him. From here, the view encompassed almost half the Courtney estate. 15,000 acres of rolling hills and steep valleys, of woodland, pasture and wheat fields that stretched down to the cliffs along the shore and reached almost to the outskirts of the port. But it was ground so familiar that Tom did not linger long on the view. "I'll go ahead and see if the coast is clear," he said, and scrambled to his feet. Crouching low, he moved cautiously to the stone wall that surrounded the chapel. Then he lifted his head and peered over. The chapel had been built by his great-grandfather, Sir Charles, who had won his knighthood in the service of good Queen Bess. As one of her sea captains, he had fought with great distinction against the Armada of Philip of Spain. Over 100 years ago, Sir Charles had built the chapel to the glory of God and in commemoration of the fleet action at Calais. He had earned his knighthood there, and many of the Spanish galleons had been driven in flames onto the beach, the rest dispersed to the storms that Vice-Admiral Drake had called the winds of God. The chapel was a handsome octagonal building of grey stone, with a tall spire that on a clear day could be seen in Plymouth, almost 15 miles distant. Tom vaulted easily over the wall and sneaked through the apple orchard to the iron-studded oak vestry door. He opened it a crack and listened intently. The silence was impenetrable. He crept inside and went to the door that opened into the nave. As he peeped in, the sunlight through the high stained-glass windows lit the interior like a rainbow. Those above the altar depicted the English fleet locked in battle against the Spaniards, with God the Father looking down approvingly from the clouds as the Spanish galleons burned. The windows above the main door had been added by Tom's own father. This time the foes who were being battered into submission were the Dutch and the hordes of Islam, while above the battle stood Sir Hal, his sword raised heroically with his Ethiopian princess at his side. Both of them were armoured, and on their shields were blazoned the cuirass pâté of the Order of St. George and the Holy Grail. The nave was empty today. The preparations for Black Billy's wedding, which would take place next Saturday, had not yet begun. Tom had the building to himself. He ran back to the vestry door and stuck his head out. He put two fingers in his mouth and gave a shrill whistle. Almost immediately his two brothers scrambled over the outer wall and ran to meet him. "Up to the belfry, Dorry," Tom ordered. And when it seemed that the redhead might still protest, he took a menacing pace towards him. Dorian scowled, but disappeared up the staircase. "Is she here yet?" Guy asked, with a hint of trepidation in his voice. "Not yet. It's still early." Tom crossed the floor and went down the dark stone staircase that led to the underground crypt. When he reached the bottom, he unbuckled the flap of the leather pouch that hung beside the sheathed dagger on his belt. He brought out the heavy iron key that he had removed from his father's study that morning, and unlocked the grille gate, then swung it open on its creaking hinges. He showed no hesitation as he entered the vault where so many of his ancestors lay in their stone sarcophagi. Guy followed him with less confidence. The presence of the dead always made him uneasy. He paused at the entrance to the crypt. There were high windows at ground level, through which glimmered an eerie light, the only illumination. Stone and marble coffins were arranged around the circular walls of the crypt. There were 16, all of the Courtneys and their wives, since great-grandfather Charles. Guy looked instinctively to the marble coffin that contained the earthly remains of his own mother in the centre of the line of his father's 3 dead wives. There was a carved effigy of her on the lid, and she was beautiful, Guy thought, a pale lily of a girl. He had never known her. Never taken suck at her bosom. The 3-day labour of giving birth to twins had been too much for such a delicate creature. She had died of blood loss and exhaustion only hours after Guy had vented his birth cry. The boys had been raised by a series of nurses and by their stepmother, who had been Dorian's mother. He crossed to the marble coffin and knelt at the head. He read the inscription in front of him. "Within this casket lies Margaret Courtney, beloved second wife of Sir Henry Courtney, mother of Thomas and of Guy, who departed this life on the 2nd of May, 1673. safe in the bosom of Christ. Guy closed his eyes and began to pray. She can't hear you, Tom told him, not unkindly. Yes, she can, Guy replied, without raising his head or opening his eyes. Tom lost interest and wandered down the row of coffins. To his mother's right lay Dorian's mother, his father's last wife. It was only 3 years ago that the cutter in which she had been sailing had overturned at the entrance to the bay, and the riptide had swept her out to sea. Despite her husband's efforts to save her, the current had been too strong and had nearly taken Howl with her. It had cast them both up in a wind-battered cove 5 miles down the coast, but by then Elizabeth had drowned, and Howl nearly so. Tom felt tears welling up from deep inside of him, for he had loved her as he could not love the mother he had never known. He coughed and brushed his eyes, forcing the tears back before Guy could see his childish weakness. Although Howl had married Elizabeth mainly to provide his orphan twins with the mother, very soon they had all come to love her, as they loved Dorian from when she had given birth to him. All of them but Black Billy, of course. William Courtney loved nobody but his father, and he was as fiercely jealous of him as a panther. Elizabeth had protected the younger boys from his vindictive attentions until the sea took her from them and left them defenceless. "You should never have left us," Tom told her softly, then glanced guiltily at Guy. But Guy had not heard him, too intent on his prayers, and Tom moved across to the other coffin, which flanked his natural mother. This belonged to Judith, the Ethiopian princess, the mother of Black Billy. The marble effigy on the lid depicted a handsome woman with the fierce, almost hawk-like features that her son had inherited from her. She was in half-armour, as befitted one who had commanded armies against the pagan. There was a sword on her belt, and a shield and helmet rested on her crest, the shield blazoned with the Coptic cross, the symbol of Christ that predated even the ministry of Rome. Her head was bared, and the bush of her hair was a dense curling crown. As he looked at her, Tom felt the hatred he bore her son rise in his chest. "The horse should have thrown you before you had a chance to whelp that cub of yours." This time he spoke aloud. Guy stood up and came to join him. "It's ill luck to speak so of the dead," he cautioned his brother. Tom shrugged. "She can't hurt me now." Guy took his arm and led him to the next sarcophagus in the row. They both knew it was empty. The lid had not been sealed. "Sir Francis Courtney, born the 6th of January, 1616, in the county of Devon. Knight of the Order of the Garter and of the Order of St. George and the Holy Grail. Navigator and sailor, explorer and warrior. Father of Henry and valiant gentleman." Guy read the inscription aloud. "Unjustly accused of piracy by the craven Dutch settlers of Cap de Bonne Esperance, and most cruelly executed by them on the 15th of July, 1668. Although his mortal remains lie on the far and savage African shore, his memory lives forever in the heart of his son Henry Courtney, and in the hearts of all the brave and faithful seamen who voyaged the ocean sea under his command." "How can Father set an empty coffin here?" Tom murmured. "I think perhaps that he intends one day to fetch back Grandfather's body," Guy answered. Tom shot him a sharp glance. "Did he tell you that?" He was jealous that his brother had been told something that he, the elder, had not. All the boys worshipped their father. "No, he didn't," admitted Guy. "But it's what I would do for my father." Tom lost interest in the discussion and strode out into the centre of the open floor, which was inlaid with a weird circular design in granites and marbles of many different colours. Brass cauldrons were set at the four points of the circle, which would hold the ancient elements of fire and earth, air and water, when the temple of the Order of St. George and the Holy Grail was convened at the full moon of the summer equinox. Sir Henry Courtney was a Nortonier Knight of the Order, as had been his father and his grandfather before him. In the centre of the domed roof of the crypt there was an air hole open to the sky above. The building was so cunningly laid out that through the opening the rays of the full moon would strike the design on the stone floor under Tom's feet, where the cryptic legend of the order was inlaid in black marble. In Arcadia Habito. Neither of the boys had yet learned the deeper meaning of this heraldic device. Tom stood upon the black Gothic letters, placed his hand over his heart, and began to recite the liturgy with which he, too, would one day be inducted into the order. "These things I believe, and I will defend them with my life. I believe there is but one God in Trinity, the Father eternal, the Son eternal, and the Holy Ghost eternal." "Amen," cried Guy softly. They'd both studied the catechism of the order assiduously, and knew the 100 responses by heart. "I believe in the communion of the Church of England, and the divine right of its representative on earth, William III, King of England, Scotland, France, and Ireland, defender of the faith." "Amen," Guy repeated. One day they would both be called upon to join this illustrious order, to stand in the light of the full moon, and to make these vows in earnest. "I will uphold the Church of England. I will confront the enemies of my sovereign lord William," Tom went on, in soaring tones that had almost lost any last timbre of childhood. He broke off abruptly as a low whistle issued from the opening in the roof above his head. "Dorry," said Guy nervously, "someone's coming." They both stood stock still, waiting for the second sharply pitched whistle that would signal alarm and danger. But there was no further warning. "It's her," Tom grinned at his brother. "I was afraid she might not come." Guy did not share his pleasure. He scratched his neck nervously. "Tom, I like this not at all." "Bollocks to you, Guy Courtney," his brother laughed at him. "You'll never know how good it is unless you try it." They heard the rustle of cloth, the patter of light feet on the staircase, and a girl burst into the crypt. She stopped in the entrance, breathing quickly, her cheeks flushed brightly from her run up the hill. "Did anyone see you leave the house, Mary?" Tom demanded. She shook her head. "Not a one of them, Master Tom. They was all too busy a piggin' thar, broth." Her voice purred with a local brogue, but its tone was light and pleasing. "She was a well-set-up lass, with a full bow and stern, older than the twins, so probably closer to 20 than 15. However, her skin was flawless and smooth as the famous Devon cream, and a tangle of dark ringlets and curls framed her pretty chubby face. Her lips were pink, soft, and moist, but there was a sly slant to her bright, knowing eyes. "Are you sure, Mary, that Master Billy didn't see you?" Tom asked insistently. She shook her head so the ringlets danced. "No. I looked in at the library afore I came, and he had his head in the books, like always." She placed both her small hands on her hips, and although they were rough and red from her work in the scullery, they almost encircled her tiny waist. Both twins' eyes followed the movement and settled on her body. Her full petticoats and ragged skirts reached halfway down her plump calves, and although her feet were bare and grubby, her ankles were slim. She saw their eyes, their expressions, and smiled with a sense of power over them. She lifted one hand and fiddled with the ribbon that held her bodice closed. Obediently, both pairs of eyes followed her hands, and she pushed out her breasts so that they strained at the retaining ribbon. "You said I would have sixpence for it," she reminded Tom, who roused himself. "That I did, Mary," he nodded. "Sixpence for both of us, Guy and me." She tossed her head and stuck out her pink tongue at him. "You're a sly one, Master Tom. 'Twas sixpence each, a shilling for the two, 'twas." "Oh, don't be daft, Mary." He reached into the purse on his belt and brought out a silver coin. He flipped it in the air. It glinted in the soft light as it spun, and he caught it on his palm, then held it out for her to inspect. "A whole silver sixpence, all for yourself." Again she shook her head and pulled loose the bow in the ribbon. "Shillin'," she repeated, and the front of her bodice opened an inch. Both the boys stared at the sliver of white skin that was revealed. It contrasted startlingly with the sun-brown, freckled shoulders above. "Shillin' or not?" She shrugged with feigned indifference. At the movement, the swell of one fat round breast popped half out, leaving just the pointed tip still hidden, but with the border of the ruby aureole that encircled her nipple peeping shyly from under the frayed edge of her blouse. Both boys were speechless. "Mice got your tongue?" she asked saucily. "Methinks there's naught for me here." She turned back to the staircase, flouncing her round bottom beneath the skirts. "Wait!" Tom called in a strangled voice. "Shilling it is, then, Mary, my pretty." "Show me first, Master Tom." She looked back over her freckled shoulder as he scratched frantically in his purse. "Here you are, Mary." He held out the coin, and she came to him slowly, swaying her hips in the way of the girls at the Plymouth docks. She took the coin from his fingers. "Do you think I'm pretty, Master Tom?" "You're the prettiest girl in all England," Tom told her fervently, and meant every word. He reached out for the big round breast, which had now come clear of the bodice. She giggled and struck away his hand. "What about Master Guy? In D first?" She looked past Tom. "You never done it afore, have you, Master Guy?" Guy swallowed hard, but could not find his voice. He dropped his eyes and flushed darkly. "It's his first time," Tom affirmed. "Take him first. I'll go after." Mary went to Guy and took his hand. "Don't be afraid." She smiled at him with those slanted eyes. "I'll not hurt you, Master Guy," she promised, and began to lead him to the far end of the crypt. Guy smelt her as she pressed against him. She had probably not bathed in a month and exuded a powerful odour of the kitchens where she worked, of bacon grease and wood smoke, the horsey tang of her sweat, the odour of lobster boiling in the pot. He felt his gorge rise. "No," he blurted out, and pulled away from her. I won't, I can't. He was close to tears. "You go first, Tom." "I got her for you," Tom told him harshly. "When you feel it, you'll go daft for it. See if you don't. Please, Tom, don't make me." Guy's voice shook, and he looked back desperately to the staircase. I just want to go home. The father will find out." "I've already given her our shilling," Tom attempted to reason with him. "You'll just waste it." Mary seized his hand again. "Come along now," she tugged at his hand. "There is a good lad. I've had you in my eye. Honest I have. You're a fine, pretty boykin, that you are." "Let Tom go first," Guy repeated, frantic now. "Oh, very well, then." She flounced towards Tom. "Let Master Tom show you the way. By now he should be able to find it blindfolded. He's been there often enough." She grabbed Tom's arm and dragged him to the nearest coffin, which happened to be that of Sir Charles, the hero of Calais, and leaned back against it. "Oh, not me only," she giggled up into his face, "but Mabel too, and Jill, unless they were both speaking a lie, and half the girls in the village, I've heard tell. It's a ram and a half you are, Master Tom." She reached down and tugged at the laces of Tom's breeches. At the same time, she stood on tiptoe and fastened her mouth on his. Tom shoved her back against the stone coffin. He was trying to say something to his twin, rolling his eyes in Guy's direction. But he was gagged by her soft, wet lips and the long, cat-like tongue she was thrusting deep into his mouth. At last he pulled his face free and gasped for air, then grinned at Guy, his chin wet and shining with the girl's saliva. "Now I'm going to show you the sweetest thing you ever will lay eyes on if you live 100 years. Mary was still leaning back against the stone coffin. Tom stooped and with practiced fingers loosed the drawstrings of her skirt and let the garment billow down and drape around her ankles. She wore nothing under it, and her body was very smooth and white. It looked as though it had been moulded from the finest candle wax. All three looked down at it, the twins in awe, and Mary with a smirk of pride. After a long minute of silence, broken only by Tom's ragged breathing, Mary lifted her blouse over her head with both hands and dropped it on the coffin lid behind her. She turned her head and looked into Guy's face. "You don't want these?" she said, and took one of her own plump white breasts in each hand. "No," she mocked him. He was dumb and shaken. Then she ran her fingers slowly down her creamy body, past the deep pit of her navel. She kicked away her skirt and planted her feet apart, still watching Guy's face. "You've never seen the likes of this little pussy cat, have you now, Master Guy?" she asked him. The curls rustled crisply under her fingers as she stroked herself. He made a choking sound, and she laughed triumphantly. "Too late now, Master Guy," she taunted him. "You had your chance. Now you must wait your turn." By this time, Tom had dropped his breeches to his ankles. Mary placed her hands on his shoulders, and with a little hop, pulled herself up, clinging to him with both her arms tight around his neck and her legs wrapped around his waist. She wore a necklace of cheap glass beads, which caught between them. The string snapped. The shiny beads cascaded down their bodies and scattered over the stone slabs. Neither seemed to notice. Guy watched with a strange mixture of horror and fascination as his twin pinned the girl against the stone lid of their grandfather's sarcophagus, thrust and pounded against her, grunting, red-faced, while the girl thrust back at him. She began to make little mewing sounds, which rose higher and louder until she was yelping like a puppy. Guy wanted to look away, but he could not. He stared in dreadful fascination as his brother threw back his head, opened his mouth wide, and let out a dreadful, anguished cry. "She's killed him," Guy thought. "And then, what are we going to tell Father?" Tom's face was bright red and shining with sweat. "Tom, are you all right?" The words were out of his mouth before he could stop them. Tom turned his head and gave him a contorted grin. "I've never been better." He let Mary drop to her feet and stepped back, leaving her leaning once more against the coffin. "Now it's your turn," he panted. "Give her your sixpenny worth, lad." Mary was also breathless, but she laughed unsteadily. "Oh, give me a minute to catch my wind. Then I'll take you for a gallop you'll not forget in many a year, Master Guy." At that moment, a sharp double whistle reverberated down the air hole in the roof of the crypt, and Guy jumped back with alarm and relief. There was no mistaking the urgency of the warning. "Cats," he exclaimed, "it's Dory on the roof. Somebody's coming." Tom hopped on one foot, then on the other, as he jerked up his breeches and hauled at the laces. "Get you gone, Mary," he snapped at the girl. She was scrabbling about on hands and knees, trying to gather up the fallen beads. "Leave those," Tom told her, but she ignored him. Her naked buttocks were marked with pink, where they had caught the edge of the coffin. He could almost make out his grandfather's inscription imprinted on the white skin, and he felt a ridiculous urge to laugh. Instead, he grabbed Guy by the shoulder. "Come on, it might be Father." That thought put wings on their feet, and they flew up the stairs, jostling each other in their haste. As they tumbled out of the vestry door, they found Dorian waiting for them, hiding in the ivy that covered the wall. "Who is it, Dorry?" Tom gasped.
"Black Billy,"
shrilled Dorian. "He's just left the stables on Sultan, and took the path straight up the hill. He'll be here in a minute." Tom gave vent to his most potent oath, learned from Big Daniel Fisher, his father's bosun.
"He mustn't catch us here. Come on."
The three raced to the stone wall. Tom boosted Dorian over it. Then he and Guy sprang over and pulled their younger brother down into the grass.
"Quiet, both of you."
Tom was snorting with laughter and excitement.
"What happened?" Dorian piped up. "I saw Mary go in. Did you do it with her, Guy?"
"You don't even know what it is," Guy tried to avoid the question.
"I do know what it is," Dorian told him indignantly. "I've seen the rams at it, and the dogs, and the cocks, and Hercules the bull, like this."
He rose on all fours and gave a lurid imitation, bucking and pumping his hips, sticking his tongue out of the corner of his mouth and rolling his eyes horribly.
"Is that what you did to Mary, Guy?"
Guy flushed furiously.
"Stop that, Dorian Courtney, do you hear me?"
But Tom gave a delighted guffaw and pushed Dorian's face into the grass.
"You dirty little monkey! I bet a guinea you'd be better at it than him, hairs or no hairs." Will you let me try next time, Tom? Dorian pleaded, his voice muffled. His face was still buried in the turf.
I'll let you try when you've got a bit more to try with, Tom said, and let him sit up. But at that moment they all heard the hoofbeats coming up the hill.
Quiet, Tom said through his giggles, and they lay behind the wall in a row, trying to control their breathing and their mirth.
They heard the horseman approach at a canter and rein down to a walk as he reached the gravelled area in front of the main doors of the chapel.
Keep down, Tom whispered to his brothers, but he pulled off the feathered cap and raised his head cautiously to peer over the top of the wall.
William Courtney sat up on Sultan. He was a superb horseman. The art had come to him naturally, perhaps some instinct from his African origins. He was slim and tall, and as usual dressed all in black. This, apart from his skin and hair pigmentation, was why his half-brothers had given him the nickname he hated so vehemently. Although today he was bareheaded, he usually wore a wide-brimmed black hat decorated with a bunch of ostrich feathers. His high boots were black, his saddle and bridle were black. Sultan was a black stallion, groomed until he shone in the pale sunlight. Horse and rider were magnificent. It was obvious that he'd come to check the arrangements for his impending marriage. The nuptials were to be held here, rather than in the bride's home chapel, for other important ceremonies were to follow. These could only be held in the chapel of the Nortanier Knights. He stopped at the front door of the chapel and stooped low in the saddle to peer inside, then straightened and rode slowly around the side of the building to the vestry door. He looked about carefully, then stared straight at Tom. Tom froze. He and the other boys were supposed to be down at the river mouth, helping Simon and his crew with the salmon nets. The itinerant labourers, whom William hired for the harvest, were fed almost entirely on salmon. It was cheap and plentiful, but they protested at this monotonous diet. The apple tree boughs must have concealed Tom from his brother's keen gaze, for William dismounted and hitched Sultan to the iron ring beside the door. He was betrothed to the middle Grenville daughter. It was to be a splendid marriage, and their father had haggled for almost a year with John Grenville, the Earl of Exeter, to agree the dowry. Black Billy's in a lather to get at her, Tom thought derisively, as he watched his brother pause on the chapel steps to slap the dust from his glistening black boots with the heavy lead-weighted riding crop he always carried. Before he entered the chapel, William glanced in Tom's direction once more. His skin was not black at all, but light amber in colour. He looked more Mediterranean than African, Spanish or Italian, perhaps. However, his hair was jet black, dense and shining, scraped back sleekly from his face and secured in a pigtail with a black ribbon plaited into it. He was handsome in a formidable, dangerous fashion, with that thin, straight Ethiopian nose and the flashing dark eyes of a predator. Tom was envious of how most young women became flustered and fluttery in his presence. William disappeared into the vestry, and Tom rose to his feet. He whispered to his brothers, "He's gone! Come on, we'll go back!" But before he could finish, there was a scream from the chapel.
"Mary!" exclaimed Tom. "I thought she'd run, but the silly little dilly is still in there."
"Black Billy has caught her," gasped Guy.
"Now there'll be trouble," said Dorian gleefully, and leapt up to get a better view of the excitement. "What do you think he'll do?"
"I don't know," said Tom, "and we aren't waiting to find out." Before he could lead them in a precipitous retreat down the gill, Mary burst out of the vestry door. Even at that distance, her terror was obvious. She ran as though pursued by a pack of wolves. A moment later, William charged out into the sunlight, following the fleeing girl.
"Come back, you little slut!" his voice carried clearly to where they still crouched behind the wall. But Mary snatched up her skirts and ran all the harder. She was heading straight towards the wall where the boys were hiding.
Behind her, William freed Sultan's reins and swung up easily into the saddle. He sent the stallion after her at a full gallop. Horse and rider overhauled the running girl swiftly.
"Stop where you are, you dirty little whore. You've been up to no good." William leaned over with the heavy riding crop in his right hand as he caught up with her. "You're going to tell me what you were going to do there." He slashed at her, but Mary dodged away. He wheeled the stallion to follow her. "You aren't going to escape me, bitch." He was smiling, a cruel, cold smile. "Please, Master William," Mary shrieked, but he swung the crop again. It hissed in the air, and she ducked under its arc with the agility of a hunted animal. Now she was running back towards the chapel, ducking through the apple trees with William after her.
"Come on," whispered Guy. "Now's our chance."
He sprang up and tumbled down the steep side of the gill, Dorian behind him. But Tom still crouched by the wall. He watched in horror as his brother caught the running girl again and rose in the stirrups over her.
"I'll teach you to listen when I tell you to stop."
He lashed at her again, and this time the crop caught her between the shoulder blades. Mary screamed at a higher pitch, a cry of agony and terror, and collapsed into the grass. The sound of that shriek chilled Tom's spine and set his teeth on edge.
"Don't do that," he said aloud,
but William did not hear. He stepped down out of the stirrups and stood over Mary.
"What mischief were you up to, drab?"
She had fallen all in a welter of skirts and bare legs, and he hit her again, aiming for her terrified white face, but Mary threw up an arm and took the lash across it. It raised a bright scarlet wheal, and she blubbered and writhed at the pain.
"Please don't hurt me, Master William!"
"I am going to beat you until you bleed, and until you tell me what you were doing in the chapel when you should be in the scullery with your greasy pots and pans."
William was smiling easily, enjoying himself.
"I didn't do no harm, sir."
Mary lowered her hands to plead with him, and could not lift them again fast enough to meet the next blow that caught her full in the face. She howled, and the blood rushed into her swollen cheek to colour it flaming scarlet.
"Please, please don't hurt me any more."
She buried her injured face in her hands and rolled over in the grass, trying to get away from him, but her skirt was rucked up under her. William smiled again as he saw that she was naked beneath it, and his next blow was delivered with relish across the soft white skin of her buttocks.
"What were you stealing, bitch? What are you doing in there?"
He hit her again, and left a scarlet weal across the back of her thighs. Her scream struck Tom just as cruelly as the crop had sliced into her flesh.
"Leave her, damn you, Billy!"
he blurted out, struck by an overpowering sense of responsibility and pity for the tortured girl. Before he had even thought about what he was doing, he was over the wall and racing to Mary's rescue. William did not hear him coming. He was absorbed in the sharp, unexpected pleasure he was experiencing from punishing this little slut. The sight of the scarlet lines on her white skin, her flailing, naked limbs, her wild shrieks, the unwashed animal smell of her, all roused him keenly.
"What were you up to?" he roared. "Are you going to tell me, or shall I beat it out of you?"
He could hardly restrain his laughter as he laid a vivid scarlet stripe across her bare shoulders and watched the muscles beneath the soft skin spasm in agony. Tom crashed into him from behind. He was a strapping lad for his age, not much shorter in height or less in weight than his older brother, and he was strengthened by his outrage and his hatred, by the injustice and cruelty of what he had watched, and by the memory of 1,000 hurts and insults he and his brothers had suffered at Black Billy's hands. And he had the advantage this time of complete surprise. He struck William in the small of the back, just as he was balanced on one leg, in the act of kicking the girl into a better position to receive the next blow from the riding crop. He was flung forward with such force that he tripped over his victim and went sprawling, rolled over once, and crashed headfirst into the bole of one of the apple trees. He lay there, stunned. Tom bent down and yanked the trembling, blubbering girl to her feet.
"Run," he told her, "as fast as you can."
He gave her a push. Mary needed no urging. She went off down the path, still weeping and howling, and Tom turned back to face the wrath of his brother. William sat up in the grass. He was not yet certain who or what had knocked him down. He touched his scalp, pushing 2 fingers into the dark, wavy hair, and brought them out smeared with blood from the small cut where he had hit the tree. Then he shook his head and stood up. He looked at Tom.
"You," he said softly, almost pleasantly.
"I should have known you would be at the bottom of this devilry."
"She's done nothing." Tom was still too buoyed up by his anger to regret his impulse.
"You might have wounded her sorely."
"Yes," William agreed. "That was my purpose. She deserved it well enough."
He stooped and picked up the crop. "But now she's gone, it's you I shall wound sorely, and take the deepest pleasure in doing my duty." He cut left and right with the weighted crop, which made a menacing hum in the air. "Now, tell me, little brother, what it was that you and that little whore were playing at. Was it something foul and dirty that our father should know about? Tell me now, before I have to whip it out of you."
"I'll see you in hell first."
This was one of their father's favourite expressions, but despite his defiance, Tom was bitterly regretting the chivalrous impulse that had propelled him into this confrontation. Now that he had lost the element of surprise, he knew himself hopelessly outmatched. His elder brother's skills were not confined to his books. At Cambridge, he had wrestled for King's College, and all in wrestling was a sport without rules, except that the use of deadly weapons was frowned upon. At the fair in Exmouth last spring, Tom had seen William throw and pin the local champion, a great ox of a man, after kicking and punching him half out of his mind. He considered turning and running. But he knew that on those long legs, even wearing riding boots, William would catch him within 100 yards. There was nothing for it. He took his stance and raised both fists, the way Big Daniel had taught him. William laughed in his face.
"By Peter and all the saints, the little cockerel wants to make a fight of it!"
He dropped the riding crop, but let his hands hang at his sides as he moved forward lazily. Suddenly he shot out his right fist. He had given no warning of the blow, and Tom only just managed to jump back. However, the fist grazed his lip, which swelled and immediately leaked the salty, slick taste of blood into his mouth. His teeth were stained, as though he had been eating raspberries.
"There we go. The first drop of claret spilt. There will be more, I warrant you, a cask of it, before we're finished with this business."
William fainted with the right again, and when Tom ducked away, he hooked at his head with the other hand. Tom blocked, as Big Daniel had shown him. William grinned.
"Ooh, the monkey has learned a few tricks."
But his eyes narrowed. He had not expected that. He fired the same fist again, and Tom ducked under it and then seized his brother's arm at the elbow in a desperate two-hand grip. Instinctively, William pulled back, and Tom used the momentum to spring forward instead of resisting, and at the same time to kick out wildly. Again, he caught the other off balance, and one of his flying kicks landed squarely in his crotch. The breath went out of William in a woof of pain, and he doubled over to clutch his injured parts with both hands. Tom swirled round and ran off down the path towards the house. Although his dark features were still contorted with pain, when he saw the younger boy go, William straightened, forced himself to ignore the pain, and launched himself after him. He was hampered by his injury, but even so he bore down inexorably on the fleeing Tom. When Tom heard the racing footfalls coming up on him, he glanced over his shoulder and lost a yard. He could hear his brother grunting, and imagined he could feel his breath on the back of his neck. There was no escape. He could not run away from him. Instead, he dropped to the ground and rolled himself into a ball. William was so close and coming on so fast that he could not stop. The only way he could avoid Tom was to jump over him. He cleared him easily, but Tom rolled onto his back in the middle of the muddy path and reached up to grab William's ankle while he was in midair. He held on with the strength of terror, and the man crashed down in the path on his face. For that instant he was helpless, and Tom scrambled to his feet, was on the point of racing away again, when his anger and hatred took over from his good sense. He saw Black Billy sprawling in the mud. The temptation was too much for him to resist. For the very first time in his life, his elder brother was at his mercy. Tom pulled back his right leg and took a full swing of the boot. He caught William in the side of the head, just in front of his ear. But the result was not what he had expected. Instead of collapsing, William let out a roar of rage and clutched at Tom's leg with both hands. With a heave, he flung the boy into the bracken beside the path, then hauled himself to his feet and launched himself at Tom before he could recover. He straddled his younger brother's chest, then leaned forward to pin his wrists to the ground above his head. Tom could not move and could hardly breathe as William's full weight crushed his ribs. William was still gasping and wheezing, but slowly his breathing eased, and he began to smile again, a twisted, painful smile. "You're going to pay for your fun, puppy. You're going to pay in heavy coin, that I promise you," he whispered. "Just let me get my breath back, and then we'll finish this business." The sweat dripped from his chin onto Tom's upturned face. "I hate you," Tom hissed up at him. "We hate you. My brothers, everybody who works here, everybody who knows you, we all hate you." Abruptly, William released his grip on one of Tom's wrists and slashed him across the face with a vicious backhanded blow. "For all these years I've been trying to teach you manners," he said softly, "and you never learn." Tom's eyes filled with tears of pain, but he still managed to gather a mouthful of saliva and spit it at the swarthy face above him. Splattered across William's chin, but he ignored it. "I'll get you, Black Billy," Tom promised in a painful whisper. "One day, I'll get you." "No," William shook his head. "I think not," he smiled. "Have you not heard of the law of primogeniture, little monkey?" He landed another full-blooded, open-handed blow against the side of Tom's head. The boy's eyes glazed, and blood appeared below one nostril. "Answer me, brother." William swung back with the other hand, knocking Tom's head across. "Do you know what it means?" He hit him again, right-handed. "Answer me, my little beauty." The next swing was left-handed, then right-handed again, and the blows settled into a rhythm. Slam with the right, slam with the left. Tom's head rolled loosely from side to side. He was swiftly losing consciousness, and the succession of blows never let up. "Primogeniture, slam. Is the slam. Right, slam. Of the slam. Firstborn, slam." The next blow came from behind Black Billy's back. Dorian had followed them down the path and had seen what was happening to his favourite sibling. The blows raining down on Tom hurt Dorian just as painfully. He looked around desperately for a weapon. There was a thick accumulation of fallen branches along the edge of the path. He picked up a dry stick as thick as his wrist and as long as his arm, and crept up behind William. He had the good sense to give no warning of what he was about to do, just quietly lifted the branch with both hands high above his head. He paused to take aim, gather all his strength, then brought down the branch on top of William's head with such force that the stick snapped in his hands. William's hands flew to his pate, and he rolled off Tom's chest. He looked up at Dorian and let out a bellow. "The whole stinking litter!" He came to his feet and swayed unsteadily. "Even the youngest cur!" "You just leave my brother be," Dorian threatened, white-faced with terror. "Run, Dorry!" Tom croaked dazedly from where he lay in the bracken, without the strength to sit up. "He'll kill you! Run!" But Dorian stood his ground. "You leave him alone," he said. William took a step towards him. "You know, Dorry, that your mother was a whore," he smiled soothingly, and took another step forward, dropping his hands from his injured head. "That makes you a son of a whore." Dorian was not certain what a whore was, but he answered furiously, "You're not to speak of my mamma like that." Despite himself, he took a pace backwards as William advanced menacingly upon him. "Mama's baby," William mocked him. "Well, your whore mamma is dead, baby." Tears flooded Dorian's eyes. "Don't say that. I hate you, William Courtney." "You too must learn some manners, baby Dorry." William's hands shot out and locked around a child's neck. He lifted Dorian easily into the air, kicking, clawing. "Manners maketh man," William said, and pinned him against the trunk of the copper beech under which they stood. "You must learn, Dorry." He pressed carefully on the child's windpipe with both fingers, staring into his face, watching it swell and turn purple. Dorian's heels kicked helplessly against the tree trunk, and he scratched at William's hands, leaving red lines on his skin, but he made no sound.
"A nest of vipers," said William. "That's what you are, asps and vipers. I'll have to clean you out."
Tom heaved himself out of the bracken and crawled to where his elder brother stood. He clutched at his legs.
"Please, Billy, I'm sorry. Hit me. Leave Dorry alone. Please don't hurt him. He didn't mean anything."
William kicked him away, still holding the child against the tree. Dorry's feet were dancing 2 feet above the ground.
"Respect, Dorry. You must learn respect."
He relaxed the pressure of his thumbs and allowed his victim to draw a single breath, then clamped down again. Dorian's silent struggles became frantic.
"Take me," pleaded Tom. "Leave Dorry alone. He's had enough."
Tom pulled himself to his feet, using the tree trunk to support himself. He tugged at William's sleeve.
"You spat in my face," William said grimly, "and this little viper tried to brain me. Now you may watch him choke."
"William," another voice, rough with outrage, cut in from close at his side.
"What in the name of the devil do you think you're playing at?"
A heavy blow fell across William's outstretched arms. He let the child drop to the muddy earth and whirled to face his father. Hal Courtney had used his scabbard to strike his eldest son's hands off the child, and now it seemed he might use it to knock William off his feet.
"Are you mad? What are you doing to Dorian?" he asked, his voice shaking with rage. "He had to be... It was only a game, Father. We were playing."
William's own rage had miraculously evaporated, and he seemed chastened.
"He has taken no harm. It was all in good part."
"You have half murdered the lad," Hal snarled, then went down on one knee to pick his youngest son out of the mud. He held him tenderly against his chest. Dorian buried his face against his father's neck and sobbed, coughed and choked for air. There were livid scarlet finger marks on the soft skin of his throat, and tears were smeared across his face. Hal Courtney glared at William.
"This is not the first time we have spoken about rough treatment of the younger ones. By God, William, we will discuss this further after dinner this evening in the library. Now get you out of my sight before I lose control of myself."
"Yes, sir," William said humbly, and started back up the path to the chapel. As he left, though, he shot Tom a look that left no doubt in the boy's mind that the matter was far from settled.
"What happened to you, Tom?"
Hal turned back to him.
"Nothing, Father," he replied staunchly. "It's nothing."
He wiped his bloody nose on his sleeve. It would have been a violation of his own code to carry tales, even of such a hated adversary as Black Billy.
"Then what happened to make your nose bleed and your face swell and turn red as a ripe apple?"
Hal's voice was gruff but gentle. He was testing the lad.
"I fell," Tom said.
"I know that sometimes you're a clumsy clod, Tom, but are you sure someone didn't push you?"
"If I did, then it's between him and me, sir."
Tom pulled himself up to his full height to disguise his aches and injuries. Hal placed an arm around his shoulder. With the other, he clasped Dorian to his chest.
"Come, boys, we'll go home now."
He took the pair down to where he had left his horse at the edge of the woods, and lifted Dorian up onto its neck in front of the saddle, before he swung up behind him. He slipped his feet into the stirrups, then reached down to take Tom by the arm and haul him up behind. Tom placed both arms around his father's waist and pressed his swollen, bruised face into the small of his back. He loved the warmth and smell of his father's body, the hardness and strength of him. It made him feel safe from all harm. He wanted to cry, but he forced back the tears. "You're not a child," he said to himself. "Dorry can cry, but you can't."
"Where's Guy?"
his father asked, without looking around. Tom almost said he ran away, but he stopped the disloyal words before they were spoken.
He went home, I think, sir."
Hal rode on in silence, feeling the two warm bodies pressed gratefully against him, and hurting for them as he knew they were hurt, yet he felt a sense of angry helplessness. This was far from the first time he had been sucked into this primeval conflict of siblings, the children of his three wives. He knew it was a competition in which the odds were heavily loaded against the youngest, and from which there could be only one possible outcome. He scowled in frustration. Hal Courtney was not yet 42. William had been born when he was only 18, yet he felt old and weighed down with care when he confronted the turmoil of his four sons. The problem was that he loved William as much, if not more, than even little Dorian. William was his firstborn, the son of his Judith, that fierce, beautiful warrior maid of Africa, whom he had loved with deep awe and passion. When she had died under the flying hoofs of her own wild steed, she had left an aching void in his existence. For many years there had been nothing to fill the gap except the beautiful infant she had left behind. Hal had reared William and taught him to be tough and resilient, clever and resourceful. He was all those things now, and more. And in him there was something of the wildness and cruelty of that dark, mysterious continent that nothing could tame. Hal feared that, and yet in all truth he would not have had it any other way. Hal himself was a hard, ruthless man, so how should he resent those qualities in his own firstborn son?
"Father, what does primogenital mean?" Tom asked suddenly, his voice muffled by Hal's cloak.
He was so in step with Hal's own thoughts that his father started. "Where did you learn that?" he asked.
I heard it somewhere," Tom mumbled. I forget where."
Hal could guess very well where it had been. But he did not press the boy, who had been hurt enough for one day. Instead, he tried to answer the question fairly, for Tom was old enough now. It was high time that he began to learn what hardships life held in store for him as a younger brother. "You mean primogeniture, Tom. It means the right of the firstborn."
"Billy," said Tom softly.
"Yes, Billy," Hal agreed frankly. "In accordance with the law of England, he follows directly in my footsteps. He takes precedence over all his younger brothers."
"Us," said Tom with a touch of bitterness.
"Yes, you," Hal agreed. "When I am gone, everything is his."
"When you are dead, you mean?"
Dorian bawled in with indisputable logic. "That's right, Dory. When I am dead."
"I don't want you to die,"
Dorian wailed, his voice still hoarse from the damage to his throat. "Promise me you won't ever die, father." "I wish I could, lad, but I can't. We're all going to die one day." Dorian was silent for a moment.
"But not tomorrow."
Hal chuckled softly. "No, no, not tomorrow. Not for many a long day, if I can help it. But one day it will happen. It always does." He forestalled the next question.
"And when it does, Billy will be Sir William," Tom said. "That's what you're trying to tell us."
"Yes. William will have the baronetcy, but that's not all. He will have everything else as well."
"Everything? I don't understand," said Tom, lifting his head from his father's back. "Do you mean High Weald? The house and the land?"
"Yes. It will all belong to Billy. The estate, the land, the house, the money."
"That's not fair," Dorian expostulated. "Why can't Tom and Guy not have some? They're much nicer than Billy. It's not fair."
"Perhaps it isn't fair, but that's the law of England."
"It isn't fair," Dorian persisted. "Billy's cruel and horrible."
"If you go through life expecting it to be fair, then you will have many sad disappointments, my boy," Hal said softly, and hugged his baby.
"I wish I could make it different for you," he thought. "When you're dead, Billy won't let us stay here at High Weald. He'll send us away."
"Well, you can't be sure of that," Hal protested.
"Yes, I can," Tom said with conviction. "He told me so, and he meant it."
"You'll make your own way, Tom. That's why you have to be clever and tough. That's why I'm hard on you sometimes, harder than I ever was on William. You must learn to fend for yourselves after I am gone." He paused. Could he explain this to them? When they were still so young, he had to try. He owed them that.
"The law of primogeniture has served to make England great.
If every time somebody died, his land was split between his surviving children, then soon the whole country would be divided into tiny, useless parcels, unable to feed a single family, and we would become a nation of peasants and paupers.
So what will we do? Tom asked. Those of us who are driven out.
The army, the navy, and the church are open to you. You might go out into the world as traders or colonists and come back from its far corners, from the ends of the oceans, with treasures and wealth even greater than William will inherit when I die. They thought about that in silence for a long time.
I'll be a sailor like you, Father. I'll sail to the ends of the oceans like you did, said Tom at last.
And I'll go with you, Tom, said Dorian.
Sitting in the front pew of the family chapel, Hal Courtney had every reason to feel pleased with himself and the world around him. He watched his eldest son waiting at the altar, while organ music filled the small building with joyous sound. William was strikingly handsome and dashing in the costume he had chosen for his wedding. For once he had eschewed his sombre black attire. His collar was of the finest Flemish lace, and his waistcoat of green velvet embroidered with golden stags. The pommel of his sword was encrusted with carnelians and lapis lazuli. Most of the women in the congregation were watching him also, and the younger ones were giggling and discussing him in whispers.
I could ask nothing more of a son, Hal told himself.
William had proved himself as an athlete and as a scholar. His tutor at Cambridge had praised his industry and capacity for learning, and he had wrestled, ridden, and hawked his way to prominence. After his studies, when he had returned to High Weald, he had proved his worth yet again as an administrator and entrepreneur. Gradually, Hal had given him more and more control over the running of the estate and the tin mines, until now he himself had almost withdrawn from overseeing the day-to-day running of the family estates. If there was anything that made Hal at all uneasy, it was that William was often too hard a bargainer, too ruthless in his treatment of the men who worked for him. More than once, men had died at the tin face, who might have been spared if a little more thought had been given to their safety, and a little more money spent on improvements to the shafts and to the haulage. Yet the profits from the mines and the estate had almost doubled in the last 3 years. That was proof enough of his competence. Now William was contracting this glittering marriage. Of course, Hal had pointed him in the direction of Lady Alice Grenville. But William had courted her, and in very short order had had her so besotted with him that she had convinced her father of the suitability of the union, despite his initial reluctance. After all, William Courtney was a commoner. Hal glanced at the Earl as he sat in the front pew across the aisle. John Grenville was older than him by 10 years. A lean man, plainly dressed, as ill-befitted one of the greatest landowners in England. His dark eyes were hooded in the unhealthy pallor of his face. He caught Hal's eye and nodded, his expression neither friendly nor hostile, although harsh words had been exchanged when it had come to the matter of Alice's dowry. In the end, she had brought with her the title to Gainsbury Farms, over 1,000 acres, in addition to the working tin mines of East and South Rushwold. The demand for tin seemed insatiable these days, and Rushwold joined the Courtney mines that William was administering so efficiently. Run together, output would grow and lower the costs of hauling the precious ore to the surface. That was not all of Alice's dowry. The final item, which he had wheedled out of the Earl, pleased Hal as much as the rest. The packet of English East India Company shares, 12,000 of the common stock, with full voting rights. Hal was already a major shareholder in and governor of the company, but these new shares would increase his voting power and make him one of the most influential men on the board after the chairman, Nicholas Childs. Yes, he had every reason to feel smug. Then what was this strange feeling that niggled like grit in the eye at his contentment? Sometimes when he rode along the cliffs and gazed out over the cold grey sea, he remembered the warm Asia waters of the ocean of the Indies. Often now, when he flew a hawk and watched its rapid wing beats against the sky, he remembered the taller, bluer sky of Africa. On some evenings, he took down his charts from his library shelves and pored over them for hours, reading the notations he had made upon them 2 decades before, and dreaming of Africa's blue hills, its white beaches and mighty rivers. Once, very recently, he had woken from a dream in a sweat and confusion. It had all been so vivid, the reliving of those tragic events. She had been with him again, the lovely golden girl who had been his first true love. Once again she had been in his arms, dying. "Sukina, my love, I will die with you." He had felt his heart break again as he said those words.
"No."
Her sweet voice began to fade.
"No, you will go on. I have travelled with you as far as I am permitted. But for you the fates have reserved a special destiny. You will live on. You will have many strong sons whose descendants will flourish in this land of Africa and make it their own."
Hal covered his eyes and bowed his head as if in prayer, in case someone in the congregation saw the glint of a tear in his eye. After a while he opened his eyes and looked down at the sons she had foreseen all those years ago. Tom was the closest to him in spirit and flesh, big-boned and strong for his age, with the iron hand of a warrior. He was restless, easily bored by routine or any task that called for long, meticulous concentration. He was no scholar, but neither did he lack in brain or cunning. In looks he was pleasant, but not handsome, for his mouth and nose were too large, but he had a strong, determined face and heavy jaw. He was impulsive and sometimes rash, almost fearless, often too bold for his own good. The bruises on his face were faded now to yellow and ugly purple, but it was typical of Tom to rush in against someone so much older and of twice his strength without a thought for the consequences. Hal had learned the truth of the confrontation in the woods below the chapel. William had told him of Mary, the scullery maid, and she had made to him an almost incoherent confession, sobbing bitterly the while.
"I'm a good girl, sir. God's truth I am. I didn't steal nothing like he said I did. It was just a bit of fun, nothing bad. Then Master William, he came into the chapel and said bad things to me, and he beat me."
Weeping copiously, she had pulled up her skirts to show the great flaming wheels across her thighs. Hal had said hastily, "Cover yourself, girl." He could guess just how innocent she was. He had noticed her before, although he usually took scant interest in the 24 or so females who worked in the main house, for she had a saucy eye and a voluptuous turn of buttock and bosom that was difficult to overlook.
"Master Tom tried to stop him, else he would have killed me, Master William would. He's a good boy, is Master Tom. He didn't do nothing."
So Tom had cut his teeth on this bit of sweetmeat, Hal thought. It would do the lad no harm. She'd probably given him a good grounding in the old game, and when William had caught them at it, Tom had rushed to her defence. The sentiment was praiseworthy, but the action was foolhardy, the object of his knight-errantry hardly worthy of such fierce loyalty. Hal had sent the girl back to the kitchens, and had a quiet word with his steward. Within 2 days he had arranged other employment for her as a serving wench at the Royal Oak in Plymouth, and she had disappeared quietly from High Weald. Hal didn't want her knocking at his door in 9 months' time to present them with a little bundle. He sighed softly. It was not long now before he would have to find other employment for Tom, too. He could not stay here much longer. He was almost a man. Aboli had recently started Tom's lessons with the sword. Hal had delayed this until the boy had the strength in his arms. He had seen youngsters who had been spoiled by a too early start with the blade. He shuddered abruptly as he thought of Tom in another fit of rage calling out his elder brother. William was a swordsman of note. He had severely wounded a fellow student at Cambridge with a thrust through the lower chest. It had been an affair of honour, but it had taken all Hal's influence and a purse of gold guineas to keep it quiet. Dueling was legal, but frowned upon. Had the man died, even Hal might not have been able to shield his son from the consequences. The thought of two of his sons taking up their feud with blades did not bear thinking about, yet it might become more than a possibility if he did not separate them soon. He would have to find Tom a berth in one of the ships of John Company, the affectionate sobriquet of the English East India Company. Tom sensed his father's gaze upon him, and turned to give him such a frank, guileless grin that Hal had to look away. Guy sat beside his twin. Guy was another problem, Hal mused, but of a different sort from Tom. Although twins ran strongly in the Courtney line, and each generation usually threw up at least one set, Tom and Guy were not identical. To the contrary, they were different in almost every way that Hal could divine. Guy was by far the better looking of the two, with delicate, rather feminine features and a graceful body that yet lacked the physical power and force of Tom's. In nature, he was cautious to the point of timidity, yet he was bright and intelligent, with the ability to apply himself to even the most repetitive tasks with all his attention. Hal did not have the gentry's usual disdain for merchants and moneylenders, and had no qualms in encouraging one of his sons to make a career in that direction. He recognised that Guy might be best suited to such a life. It was hard to imagine him as a warrior or a sailor. Hal frowned. There were numerous openings in John Company for clerks and secretaries, safe, secure jobs that could lead to swift advancement, especially for a bright, industrious young man whose father was a governor of the company. He would speak to Childs next week when they met. Hal intended to leave for London early the following morning, directly after he had seen William wed safely to Lady Alice, and the transfer of her dowry into the Courtney estate. The horses were standing ready, and Big Daniel and Aboli could have them harnessed to the coach and on the way within an hour of Hal calling for them. Even at their best speed, though, it would take at least 5 days to get up to London, and the quarterly meeting of the company board was due to be held on the first day of next month. "I'll have to take the boys with me," he thought suddenly, and it was a measure of his concern that he had made that decision. It would be tempting Providence to leave them at High Weald, with William as master of the estate, and himself not there to mediate and protect. Even Dorian had best come, he decided. He looked down fondly at his youngest son, perched beside him on the pew, and received in return a sunny, adoring smile. Dorian wriggled a little closer to him on the hard oak bench. Hal felt strangely moved by the contact of that small body. He placed a casual hand on the boy's shoulder. "It's too early to tell how this one will turn out," he thought, "but it seems that he might have all the good points of the others and fewer of their weaknesses. But it is still far too soon to tell." At that moment he was distracted by the organ music, as it burst dramatically into the bridal march. Then there was a rustle and hum, as the congregation turned in their seats and strained for a first glimpse of the bride. Although the sun was not yet clear of the treetops, and only a few stray rays were catching the high gables and towers of the big house, the entire household turned out to see them away to London. From William, with his new bride at his side, Ben Green, the estate steward, Evan, the house steward, right down to the lowest kitchen maid and groom. In order of seniority, they were marshalled down the main staircase that led up to the front doors, and the lowliest servants were gathered in orderly ranks on the front lawn. Big Daniel and Aboli were on the coachman's box, and the horses were snorting steam from their nostrils in the morning chill. Hal embraced William briefly, while Alice, pink and glowing with happiness and love, clung adoringly to her new husband's arm. On their father's instructions, the boys lined up, unsmiling, behind him, to shake their elder brother's hand, and then, whooping with excitement, raced each other down to the waiting carriage. "Can I ride up with Aboli and Big Daniel?" Tom pleaded, and his father nodded indulgently. "Me too," Dorian danced beside him. "You ride in the coach with me and Mr. Walsh." Mr. Walsh was their tutor, and Dorian faced 4 days of captivity with him and his books, Latin, French, and arithmetic. "Please, father, why can't I?" Dorian demanded, then immediately answered himself, "I know, because I'm the youngest." "Come on, Dorry." Guy took his hand and pulled him into the coach. "I'll help you with your lessons." The hardships and injustices of youth were immediately forgotten as Aboli cracked his whip, the carriage jerked and set off with the gravel crunching under the iron-shod wheels. Guy and Dorian leaned from the window to wave and shout farewell to their favourites among the household staff until they turned at the crossroads and High Weald was hidden from their view. On the box, Tom sat ecstatically between two of his favourite men. Big Daniel was a great hulk, with a mane of silver hair bristling out from under his cocked hat. He possessed not a single tooth in his head, so when he chewed, his weathered face folded like the leather bellows of a blacksmith's forge. It was well known that even at his age, he was the strongest man in Devonshire. Tom had seen him lift a recalcitrant horse in the air and dump it on its back with all four legs in the air, and hold it there effortlessly while the blacksmith shod it. He had been boatswain for Francis Courtney, and when Tom's grandfather had been killed by the Dutch, Big Daniel had served the sun, had sailed the southern oceans with Hal Courtney, had fought with him against pagan and Dutchman, against pirate and renegade and a dozen other enemies. He had played nurse to William and the twins, had carried them on his back and dandled them with huge gentle hands. He could tell the most enchanting stories that any small boy could dream of, build models of tall ships, so beautifully realistic in every detail that it seemed they might at any moment sail over the horizon to some stirring adventure, bearing Tom away with them on the quarter-deck. He had the most intriguing repertoire of oaths and sayings that Tom rehearsed only in the company of Dorian and Guy, for to recite them in the presence of William or his father or any other grown-up would have led to instant retribution. Tom loved Big Daniel dearly. Outside his own immediate family, there was only one other person he loved more. Abberley sat on Tom's other side, holding the reins in his huge black hands. "You hold the blunderbuss." Knowing what pleasure it would give him, Abberley handed the hideous weapon to Tom. Although its barrel was shorter than Tom's arm, it could hurl a devastating double handful of goose shot from the gaping bell-shaped muzzle. "If a highwayman tries to stop us, you give him a bellyful, Klebe." Tom was almost overwhelmed by the honour, and sat up straight between them, silently praying for the chance to use the heavy weapon he cradled in his lap. Abberley had used his pet name. Klebe meant hawk, in the language of the forests of Africa. It was a nickname Tom delighted in. Abberley had taught him the language of the forest, "because," he had explained, "that is where your destiny will take you. It has been prophesied by a wise and beautiful woman long ago. Africa awaits you. I, Abberley, must prepare you for that day when you step on her soil for the first time." Abberley was a prince of his own tribe. The patterns of ritual scars that covered his black face in raised whorls and ridges were proof of his royal blood. He was an expert with any weapon he laid his hands on, from an African fighting stick to the finest Toledo rapier. Now that his twins were of the correct age, Hal Courtney had entrusted to Abberley the task of teaching them swordsmanship. Abberley had trained Hal at the same age, and William too. He had moulded each of them into expert swordsmen. Tom had taken to the blade with the same natural ability as his father and his half-brother, but it grieved Abberley that Guy did not show the same eagerness or aptitude. "How old do you think Abberley is?" Dorian had once asked. Tom had replied with all the wisdom of his superior age. "He's even older than father. He must be 100 years at least." Abberley had not a hair on his cannonball head, not a single thread of grey to betray his true age. And though wrinkle and scar were so intertwined on his features as to be inextricable, his body was lean and muscular, his skin smooth and glossy as polished obsidian. Nobody, not even Abberley himself, knew how old he was. The stories he told were even more fascinating than Big Daniel's best. He told of giants and pygmies, of forests filled with marvellous animals, great apes who could rip a man apart as though he were a grasshopper, of creatures with necks so long they could eat the leaves off the tops of the tallest trees, of deserts where diamonds the size of apples glittered in the sun like water, and mountains made of solid gold. "One day I'll go there," Tom told him fervently at the end of one of these magical stories. "Will you come with me, Abberley?" "Yes, Klebe. We will sail there together one day," Abberley promised. Now the carriage jolted and crashed over the uneven surface and splashed through the mud holes, and Tom perched between the two men, trying to contain his excitement and impatience. When they reached the crossroads before Plymouth, a skeletal figure was hanging in chains from the gibbet, still wearing waistcoat breeches and boots. "He's been an in there for a month come next Sunday." Big Daniel lifted his cocked hat to the grinning skull of the executed highwayman, from which the crows had picked most of the flesh.
Godspeed, John Warkin. Put in a good word for me with old Nick.
Instead of continuing into Plymouth, Aberley swung the horses onto the wide, well-travelled tracks that led eastward towards Southampton and London.
London, the greatest city in the world.
5 days later, when they were still 20 miles off, they saw its smoke on the horizon. It hung in the air and mingled with the clouds like the great dun pall of a battlefield. The road took them along the bank of the Thames, broad and busy, bustling with an endless procession of small craft, barges, lighters and bumboats, loaded deeply with timber and building stone, with bags of wheat and lowing cattle, with boxes, bales and kegs, the commerce of a nation. The river traffic grew denser as they approached the Pool of London, where the tall ships were anchored, and they passed the first buildings, each surrounded by open fields and gardens. They could smell the city now, and the smoke closed over their heads, shading the sun. Each chimney stack was belching forth its dark fumes to deepen the gloom. The smell of the city grew stronger, the reek of green hides and new cloth in bales, of rotten meat and other strange, intriguing odours, of men and horses, of rats and chickens, the sulphurous stench of burning coal and raw sewage. The river waters turned dung brown, and the roadway became congested with cart and carriage, coach and dray. The open fields gave way to endless buildings of stone and brick. Their roofs huddled together, and the side streets became so narrow that two carriages could not pass each other. Now the river was almost obscured by the warehouses that stood four square along either bank. Aberley weaved their own carriage through the multitude, exchanging cheerful banter and insult with the other drivers. Beside him, Tom could not drink it all in. His eyes darted back and around, his head twisted on his shoulders, and he chattered like an excited squirrel. Hal Courtney had given in to Dorian's pleading and allowed him to scramble onto the carriage roof, where he sat behind Tom and added his shouts and laughter to those of his elder brother. At last they crossed the river on a mountainous stone bridge so massive that the river tide built up around its piles and swirled like a brown maelstrom through the piers. There were stalls along its length, where ragged hucksters shrieked their wares to the passers.
"Fresh lobsters, me darlings! Live oysters and cockles! Ale, sweet and strong, drunk for a penny, dead drunk for tuppence!"
Tom saw one man puke copiously over the side of the bridge, and a drunken drab spread her tattered skirts around her as she squatted and peed in the gutter. Officers in splendid uniforms from King William's Guards regiments, back from the wars, strutted through the throng with pretty girls in bonnets on their arms. Warships were anchored in the river, and Tom eagerly pointed them out to Daniel.
"Aye," Daniel spat tobacco juice over the side. "Aye, that's the old dreadnought, 74 guns. She were at the Medway. That one over there is the Cambridge."
Daniel reeled off the names of glory, and Tom thrilled to hear them.
"Look there," he cried. "That must be St. Paul's Cathedral."
Tom recognised it from the pictures in his schoolbooks. The dome was only half complete, open to the sky and covered with a spider's web of scaffolding. Guy had heard him and stuck his head out of the carriage window.
"New St. Paul's," he corrected his twin. "The old cathedral was completely destroyed in the Great Fire. Master Wren is the architect, and the dome will be almost 365 feet high."
But the attention of his two brothers on top of the carriage had moved on.
"What happened to those buildings there?"
Dorian pointed out the smoke-blackened ruins that were interspersed with the newer edifices along the banks of the river.
"They were all burned down in the fire," Tom told him. "See how the builders are at work."
They crossed the bridge into the crowded streets of the city. Here the press of vehicles and humanity was denser still.
"I were here before the fire," Daniel told them,
"long before you nippers were even thought of.
The streets were half as broad as they are now, and the people emptied the chamber pots into the gutters."
He went on to delight the boys with other graphic details of the conditions that had prevailed in the city only 20 years previously. In some of the open carriages they passed were grand gentlemen dressed in the height of fashion, and with them ladies in bright silk and satin, so beautiful that Tom stared at them in awe, sure that they were not mortals, but heavenly angels. Some of the other women who leaned from the windows of the houses that crowded the street did not seem so sacred. One singled out Abberley and screeched an invitation to him. "What does she want to show Abberley?" Dorian piped, wide-eyed. Daniel ruffled his flaming red hair.
"Better for you if you never find out, Master Durry, for once you do, you'll never know peace again."
They came at last to the plough, and the carriage rumbled over the cobbles as Abberley wheeled it up to the entrance of the inn. The host rushed out to receive them, bowing and dry-washing his hands with delight.
"Sir Hal, welcome. We were not expecting you until the morrow."
"The road was better than I feared. We made good time." Hal stepped down stiffly.
"Give us a pitcher of small beer to wash the dust from our throats," he ordered, as he stamped into the inn and flung himself down into one of the chairs in the front parlour.
"I have your usual chamber ready for you, Sir Hal, and a room for your lads."
"Good, and have your grooms take care of the horses, and find a room for my servants."
I have a message from Lord Childs for you, Sir Hal. He charged me most strictly to send him word the minute you arrived."
"Have you done so?"
Hal looked at him sharply. Nicholas Childs was the chairman of the governors of the English East India Company, but he ran it as though it were his personal fief. He was a man of vast wealth and influence in the city and at court. The Crown was a major shareholder in the company, and thus Childs had the ear and favour of the sovereign himself. Not a man to treat lightly.
"I have this minute sent a message to him."
Hal quaffed from the pitcher of beer and belched politely behind his hand.
"You can show me up now."
He stood, and the host led him up the stairs, backing ahead of him and bowing at every third step. Swiftly, Hal approved the accommodation. His own chamber had a salon and private dining room. The boys were in the room opposite, and Walsh, their tutor, in the room beside them. They would use this as their schoolroom, for Hal was determined that they miss not a day of their studies.
"Can we go out and see the town, please, Father?"
Tom begged. Hal glanced at Walsh.
"Have they finished the lessons you set for them on the journey?"
Master Guy has indeed, but the others," Walsh said primly.
"You complete the task that Master Walsh has given you," Hal scowled at his sons, "to his complete satisfaction before you set a foot outside the front door."
As he turned away, Tom made a ferocious face at Walsh's back. The messenger from Nicholas Childs arrived before Abberley and Daniel had finished bringing up the heavy leather trunks that had been strapped on the roof of the carriage. The liveried footman bowed and handed Hal the sealed sheet of parchment. Hal gave him a coin and split the wax seal of the East India Company with his thumbnail. The letter had been penned by a secretary.
"Lord Childs requests the pleasure of your company to supper at 8 o'clock this evening at Bombay House."
Below this was a note in Childs' own ornate hand.
"Oswald Hyde will be the only other guest. N.C.
Hal whistled softly. A private supper with the old man and the Chancellor of His Majesty King William III.
"Something interesting afoot?"
He smiled and felt the tingle of excitement run through his veins.
Between them, Abberley and Daniel had scrubbed the mud of the road off the carriage and curried the horses until once again their coats shone like polished metal.
Hal had plenty of time to bath and have his clothes sponged by the chambermaid, before it was time to set out to keep his appointment with Childs. Bombay House stood behind high walls and was set in substantial gardens within a stone's throw of the Inns of Court, an easy stroll from the headquarters of the East India Company on Leadenhall Street. There were guards at the high wrought-iron gates, but they swung open the gates as soon as Abberley announced his master. Three footmen were waiting at the double doors of the house to usher Hal in and take his cloak and hat. Then the major domo led him on a march through a succession of grand rooms hung with mirrors and huge oil paintings of ships, battles and exotic landscapes, and lit by forests of wax candles in crystal chandeliers and gilt oil lamps held aloft by statues of nymphs and blackamoors. As they went further, the grand public rooms gave way to meaner surroundings, and Hal realised that they had entered the private areas of the great house, closer to the kitchens and the servants' quarters. At last they paused before a door so small and insignificant that he might easily have passed it by, but the head steward knocked once with his staff.
"Enter!"
boomed a familiar voice from the far side, and Hal, stooping through the opening, found himself in a small but richly decorated cabinet. The panelled walls were hung with tapestries from Arabia and the Indies, and the space was only just sufficient to accommodate the large table piled high with silver chafing dishes and gilt tureens, which emitted succulent aromas and enticing wisps of steam. "Punctual as usual," Lord Childs complimented him. He was sitting at the head of the table, overflowing the large padded chair. "Forgive me for not rising to greet you properly, Courtney. Damned gout again." He indicated his foot, swathed in bandages, resting on a stool. "You have met Oswald, of course." "I have had that honour," Hal bowed to the Chancellor. "Good evening, my lord. We met at Mr. Samuel Pepys' house last August." "Good evening, Sir Henry. I well recall our meeting." Lord Hyde smiled and gave him a seated half-bow. "You are not the kind of man one readily forgets." It was a propitious start to the evening, Hal realized. Childs waved him easily and informally to the chair at his side. "Sit here so we can talk. Take off your coat and wig, man. Let's be comfortable." He glanced at Hal's thick dark hair, only lightly laced with silver. "Oh, of course, you don't wear a wig. Damned sensible. We are all slaves to fashion, we unfortunates who live in the city." The other two had close-cropped heads and were in their shirt sleeves, their collars loosened. Childs had a napkin tied around his neck, and they had not waited for Hal before beginning to eat. Judging by the pile of empty oyster shells, Childs had already accounted for several dozen. Hal shrugged out of his coat, passed it to a footman, then took the proffered chair. "What do you fancy, Courtney, the hock or the Madeira?" Childs beckoned to one of the servants to fill Hal's glass. Hal selected the hock. He knew from past experience that it was to be a long evening, and that the Madeira was deceptively sweet but powerful. Once his glass was charged and a platter of huge Colchester oysters in front of him, Childs dismissed the servants with a wave so that they could talk freely. Almost immediately they were away on the vexing question of the Irish War. The deposed King James had sailed to Ireland from France to raise an army among his Catholic supporters there, and was attacking the forces loyal to King William. Oswald Hyde bemoaned the cost of the campaign, but Childs rejoiced at the successful defence of Londonderry and Enniskillen by His Majesty's arms. "You can be certain that as soon as the King has taken care of the Irish, he will turn his full attention back to France." Oswald Hyde sucked another oyster from its shell and looked unhappy, an expression that seemed to come to him naturally. "I shall have to go back to Parliament for another appropriation." Even though he lived in the country, Hal kept himself well informed on the events of the day, for he had many good friends in London and corresponded with them regularly. He was able to follow the weighty twists and turns of the discussion and even to make his own noteworthy contributions. "We have little choice in the matter," he said. "Once Louis invaded the Palatinate, we were forced to act against him in accordance with the terms of the Alliance of Vienna." He had expressed an opinion with which the others concurred, and he sensed their approval, although Hyde continued to bewail the expense of a continental war. "I agree there must be war with France, but in God's name, we have not yet paid off the costs of the Dutch war and the fire. The Black Boy and Jamie left us with debts owing to every bank in Europe." The Black Boy was the nickname of Charles II, the Merry Monarch. Jamie was James II, who had succeeded him and ruled for 3 scant years before his overt Roman Catholicism forced him to flee to France. William, the stadtholder of the United Provinces of the Netherlands, and fourth in line of succession, had been invited, with Mary his wife, to take the throne of England. Mary was the daughter of James, which made their claim to the throne all the more valid, and, of course, they were staunch Protestants. Once the oysters had been dealt with, Childs called back the footman to serve the other courses. He fell upon a Dover sole as though it were an enemy. And then they went on to the lamb and the beef, with 3 different flavours of soup from the silver gilt tureens to wash them down. A good red claret replaced the rather insipid hock. Hal sipped sparingly at his glass, for the conversation was fascinating and opened insights into the interwoven structure of power and world politics which he was seldom vouchsafed. He would not let even the finest wines cloud his mind. Their talk ranged widely from the coronation of Peter as the Tsar of Russia to the incursions of the French into Canada, from the massacre of their settlers at Lachine by the Iroquois Indians to the rebellion of the Marathas against the rule of the Mughal Emperor Aurangzeb in India. This last item of news led the conversation directly to the true reason for this meeting, the affairs and fortunes of the English East India Company. Hal sensed the change that came over his companions in the way that they regarded him. Their eyes upon him became shrewd and appraising.
I understand that you are a considerable shareholder in the company, Lord Hyde asked innocently.
I was fortunate enough to purchase a little of the company stock when I returned from the East in the 70s, Hal admitted modestly, and since then from time to time, when fortune has been kind, I have added to my holdings. Childs waved away his disclaimer. All the world is aware of the distinguished exploits of you and your father during the Dutch Wars and thereafter, and the very considerable additions that you made to the privy purse from the prizes of war and the fruits of your trading voyages to the Spice Islands and the eastern coasts of the African continent. He turned to the Chancellor. Sir Henry controls 4.5% of the company's stock, which does not include the dowry of Alice Grenville, who so recently married his eldest son, he concluded dryly. Hyde looked impressed as he mentally calculated the monetary value that represented.
"Ah, the valiant and resourceful sea captain you have proved yourself," Hyde murmured.
"And a prudent investor. You richly deserve those rewards." He was watching Hal with a piercing gaze, and Hal knew that they were coming at last to their true purpose. "Moreover, your personal interests are closely linked to our own," the Chancellor went on quietly, rubbing his cropped pate so that the short, stiff hairs rasped under his fingers. We are all stockholders, the Crown the largest of all. Thus, the recent news from the East Indies affects us all most painfully.
Hal felt the sudden constriction of dread in his chest. He straightened in his chair, and his voice was tight as he murmured, Forgive me, my lord, but I arrived in London only this morning, and I have heard no news.
You are fortunate, then, for the news is not good, Childs grunted, and lifted a lump of beef, dripping blood, to his mouth. He chewed and swallowed, then took a gulp of the claret. 2 weeks ago, the company's ship Yeoman of York tied up at the East India docks. She was 62 days out from Bombay with a cargo of cotton and cochineal, and dispatches from Gerald Angier, the governor of the colony.
Childs frowned and shook his head, reluctant to speak the next words. We have lost 2 ships, the Minotaur and the Albion Spring.
Hal rocked back in his chair, as though he had taken a punch to the head.
Those two are the pride of the fleet, he exclaimed.
It was almost impossible to believe. The East Indiamen, those stately, magnificent vessels, were the lords of the ocean, built not only for the carrying of cargo, but for the prestige of the great and prosperous company that owned them, and of the English crown, under whose charter they sailed.
Wrecked? Hal hazarded.
Even the might of the company must be shaken by the magnitude of the loss. One such vessel sunk was a terrible blow. 2 ships lost was a disaster, perhaps worth £100,000 with the cargoes.
Were they wrecked? He demanded.
The Orgullis Bank, the coral reefs of the Mascarenes?
They were not wrecked, said Childs ominously.
What then?
Pirates, said Childs.
Corsairs.
Are you sure?
How can we know that? The East Indiamen were built for speed and heavily armed for just such a contingency. It would take a warship of force to capture one. When this news spread, the value of the company's stock would plunge. His own investments would be slashed by thousands, nay, tens of thousands of pounds.
For months now, both ships have been overdue. We had no news of either, Childs said. But it seems that a single seaman escaped from the Minotaur. He was almost 40 days at sea, clinging to some piece of wreckage, drinking but a few drops of rainwater and eating raw fish he was able to catch, until he was at last thrown up on the wild African coast. He walked for weeks along the shore to reach the Portuguese settlement at Lobito. There he was able to find a berth on a sloop bound for Bombay. He told his story to Governor Angier,
who sent the seaman and his dispatches back to us on board the Yeoman of York. "Where is the seaman now?" Hal demanded. "Have you spoken to him? Is he reliable?" Giles held up one hand to halt the flood of questions. "He is in a safe place and well cared for. But we don't yet want him telling his story on the streets of London or in a coffee house." Hal nodded. That made good sense. "And yes, I have spoken to him at length. He seems a sensible lad, tough and resourceful, if his account is true, which I think it is." "What does he say happened?" "In essence, the Minotaur came upon a small dhow in distress off the island of Madagascar and took off her crew of a dozen before she sank. But that first night the survivors seized control of the deck during the middle watch. They had concealed weapons on their persons, and they slit the throats of the officers of the watch. Of course, the crew of the Minotaur should have had small trouble regaining the ship from such a tiny band of pirates, but almost immediately a fleet of small boats swarmed out of the darkness, obviously in response to a signal, and the band of pirates already on board were able to prevent the ship's company from serving the guns or otherwise defending themselves until it was too late." "But how did this man escape?" "Most of the Minotaur's men were massacred, but this man, Wilson is his name, convinced the pirate captain that he would enlist with his band and lead him to other plunder. Wilson then seized his first opportunity to escape and slipped overboard through a gunport with a small wooden keg as a float." Childs opened a silver casket and brought out a long brown object that looked like a piece of dead tree bark. "Tobacco leaves rolled into a stick," he explained. "Spanish, from their colonies in America. They call it a cigarro. I have come to prefer them to a pipe. Will you try one? Here, let me prepare it for you." He made a fuss of sniffing it and cutting off a sliver of the dark tobacco from one end. Hal accepted it and sniffed it suspiciously. The aroma was surprisingly pleasing. He followed Child's example and lit the end of the tube from the burning taper Childs held for him. He puffed cautiously and found that even though he was distressed by what he had just learned, the taste was to his liking, better than any pipe he had ever taken. By now, both other men were puffing on their cigarros, which gave Hal a few minutes to consider the problem with which Childs had presented him. "You said two ships were lost," he said. "Yes," Childs agreed. "The Albion Spring, only weeks before the Minotaur, taken by the same gang of cutthroats." "How can we be sure of that?" "The pirate captain boasted of his exploits to this man Wilson." After another long silence, Hal asked, "What do you intend to do about this, my lord?" Then his pulse quickened as he saw the two men exchange glances, and he had the first inkling as to why he had been invited to this intimate meeting. Giles wiped beef fat from his jowls with the back of his hand, then winked at Hal like a conspirator. "We are going to send someone to deal with this pirate fellow, Djangiri. That's the rascal's name, Djangiri." "Who will you send?" asked Hal, already knowing the answer. "Why, you, of course. But, my lord, I am now a farmer and a county squire." "Of only a few years' standing," Hyde cut in. "Before that, you were one of the most eminently successful mariners in the southern and eastern oceans." Hal was silent. It was true, of course. These two knew everything about him. They could almost certainly detail every voyage he had made, and Hyde would have in his records every return of treasure and precious cargo he had made to the treasury. "My lords, I have a family, four sons to care for, and no woman to share the responsibility. That is the reason I no longer go seafaring." "Yes, I know why you gave up the sea, Courtney, and you have my deepest condolences for the loss of your wife. But, on the other hand, even your youngest son must now be of the age when you yourself first went to sea. There is no reason why you cannot find berths for every one of your offspring aboard a well-found ship." That was also true. Childs had clearly planned his strategy with great attention to detail. But Hal was determined not to make it easy for him. "I could not leave my responsibilities at High Weald. Without careful administration of my estates, I would be beggared." "Oh, my dear Sir Henry," Hyde smiled. My own son was at King's College with your William. They are still the greatest of friends and correspond regularly. I understand that the administration of your estates has become almost solely the charge of young William, and that you spend much of your time hawking, hunting, reading, and reminiscing with your old shipmates. Hal flushed with anger. Was that William's estimation of his worth and contribution to the running of High Weald and the mines? If this fellow Jungiri is not dealt with swiftly, we will all be beggared, Childs added. You are the best man for the job, and we all know it. The suppression of piracy is the concern of the King's Navy, Hal retorted stubbornly. Indeed it is, Hyde agreed. But by the end of the year we will be at war with France, and the King's Navy will have more pressing matters with which to attend. It may be several years before the Admiralty can turn its mind to policing the far oceans of the globe, and we dare not wait that long. Jungiri already has two ships of great power under his command. Who can say that in a year or two he will not be strong enough to attack Bombay or our factories on the Carnatic coast? Your shares in the company would be worth little if he succeeded. Hal moved restlessly in his chair and fiddled with the stem of his wine glass. This was what he had been waiting for secretly during these past months of boredom and inactivity. His blood was charging, his mind racing, flirting from idea to idea like a sunbird on a flowering tree, darting from bloom to drink its nectar. I have no ship, he said. He had sold the Golden Bough when he came back to Devon. She was tired, and her hull eaten half away by shipworm. I would need a ship of equal or superior force to the Minotaur or the Albion Spring. I can offer you a squadron of two fine ships, Childs countered easily. Your flagship would be the new Seraph, the finest vessel the company has ever built. 36 guns and fast as a gull. She is this very day fitting out at Deptford Yard. She can be ready for sea by the month's end. And the other? Hal demanded. The Yeoman of York, the same ship that carried this lad Wilson back from Bombay. It will have completed its refit by the end of the week, and be ready for sea again. Also 36 guns. Captain Edward Anderson, a fine seaman. Yes, I know him well, Hal nodded. But what authority would I sail under? Hal was determined to resist a little longer. By noon tomorrow, Hyde promised, I can deliver to you a commission signed by His Majesty's own hand, authority to seek out and destroy or take as prize the ships and property of the Corsairs. What terms of prize? Hal turned his full attention to him. 1/3 to the Crown, 1/3 to the East India Company, and the last third to you and your crew, Hyde suggested. If I were to go, and there is no guarantee that I shall, I would like to have half to myself and my men. It is true, then, Hyde looked miserable. You strike a hard bargain. We can discuss that when you agree to take the commission. I should like also to be able to trade for my own account during the voyage. It was one of the tenets of company policy that its captains should not indulge in private trade, and thereby risk a conflict of interest and loyalty. Child's face darkened, and his jowls wobbled with outrage. Under no circumstances, I cannot agree to that. It would set a dangerous precedent. Then he saw that Hal had prepared the trap, and that he had walked straight into it. Very well, Hal said quietly. I will forego that right, if you grant me the half share of the prize. Childs gulped and spluttered at his effrontery, but Hyde smiled lugubriously. He has you there, Nicholas. One or the other, which is it to be, the prize money or the right to trade? Childs was thinking furiously. The prize money might far outstrip any trading profit that even this cunning and resourceful mariner might garner along the Asian and African coasts, but the right to trade was sacred and reserved to the company alone. Very well, he agreed at last. Half the prize, but none of the trading profits. Hal scowled, but was well content. He nodded, apparently reluctantly. I will need a week to think on it. You do not have a week, Hyde remonstrated. We need your answer this very night. His Majesty needs my reply at the meeting of his cabinet in the morning.
There is too much for me to consider before I can take up the commission. Hal sat back and folded his arms in a gesture of finality. If he delayed, there was a chance he might squeeze other concessions out of them. Henry Courtney, Baron Dartmouth, Hyde murmured. Does not the title have a satisfying ring? Hal unfolded his arms and leaned forward, taken so off guard that he allowed his eagerness to light his features. A peerage. He had never before allowed himself to think of it. Yet it was one of the few things in this world he lacked. You mock me, sir, he murmured. Please make clear your meaning. Take up the commission we offer immediately, and bring back the head of this young giddy rogue in a pickle barrel, and I give you my solemn word that a barony is yours. What say you, Sir Hal? Hal began to grin. He was a commoner, albeit of the highest rank, but this next step up the ladder would enter him into the nobility and the House of Lords. You are the one who drives a hard bargain, my lord. I can no longer resist either your blandishments or my duty. He raised his glass, and the other two followed his example. Fair winds and a good chase, he suggested as the toast. Bright gold and glory. Hyde made a better one, and they drained their glasses. When they lowered their glasses, Hyde dabbed his lips with his napkin and asked, You have not yet been presented at court, have you, Sir Hal? When Hal shook his head, he went on, If you are one day to become a peer of the realm, we must see to that before you leave London. 2 o'clock in the afternoon on this coming Friday at St. James's Palace. The King is holding a levee before he sails for Ireland to take charge of the campaign against his father-in-law. I shall send a man to your lodgings to guide you to the palace. Alfred Wilson was a surprise. With such a name, Hal had expected a stalwart English tar with a Yorkshire or Somerset accent. At Hal's request, Childs had released the seaman from wherever he was being held and sent him to Hal at the inn. He stood in the centre of the floor of the private salon and twisted his cap in his slim dark hands. "You are English?" Hal demanded. Wilson respectfully touched the hank of thick dark hair that spilled onto his forehead. "My father was born in Bristol, Captain." "But your mother was not," Hal guessed. "She was an Indian, a Mogul, a Mussulman, sir." Wilson was darker even than Hal's own William, and as handsome. "Do you speak her language, Wilson?"
"Yes, sir, and write it. My mother was of high birth, begging your pardon, sir."
"Then you write English also?"
Hal liked the look of him.
And if his story of the escape from Yangiri were true, he was indeed resourceful and clever to boot.
"Yes, sir."
Hal was surprised. Few seamen were literate. He considered him thoughtfully. "Do you speak any other language?"
"Only Arabic,"
Wilson shrugged self-deprecatingly.
"Better and better."
Hal smiled and switched into Arabic to test him. He had been taught it by his first wife, Judith, and had honed his knowledge of it on many voyages along the coasts of Africa and Araby.
"Where did you learn?"
His tongue was a little rusty from disuse of the guttural tones of Arabia.
"I sailed many years before the mast with a crew that was mostly Arab." Wilson's command of the language was rapid and fluent.
"What rating did you hold on the Minotaur?"
"Warrant officer, sir."
Hal was delighted. To hold the rank of a watchkeeping officer at his age, he must be a bright one.
"I must have him," Hal decided.
"I want to hear from you everything you can tell me of the taking of the Minotaur. But more important, I want you to tell me about Yangiri."
"Begging your pardon, Captain, but that will take a while."
"We have all day, Wilson." Hal pointed to the bench against the far wall. "Sit there." When he hesitated, Hal went on. "You said it would take time. Sit down, man, and get on with it."
It took almost 4 hours. And Walsh, the tutor, sat at the table and made notes, as Hal instructed him. Wilson spoke quietly and without emotion until he had to describe the murder of his shipmates by the pirates. Then his voice choked, and when Hal looked up, he was surprised to see that Wilson's eyes were bright with tears. He sent for a pot of beer to soothe the man's throat and give him a chance to regain his composure. Wilson pushed the tankard aside.
I don't take strong liquor, sir.
Hal was delighted.
Drink was the demon of most seamen.
Never?
He asked.
No, sir. My mother, you understand, sir. You are a Christian.
Yes, sir, but I can't forget my mother's teaching.
Yes, I understand.
By God, I need this one,
Hal thought. He's a gem among men.
Then an idea occurred to him. During the voyage out, I will have him teach my lads Arabic. They will need it on the coast.
By the time they had finished, Howell had a vivid picture of what had happened on board the Minotaur, and of the man he was going out to confront.
I want you to go over all this again in your mind, Wilson. If there is anything you have forgotten, any detail that may be useful, I want you to come back and tell me.
Very well, Captain. Wilson stood up to leave. Where will I find you, sir?
Hal hesitated.
I hope you can keep your tongue from wagging,
he asked, and when the man nodded, he went on.
I know that you have been kept from telling the story of the taking of the Minotaur. You can give me your word that you will not be spouting your story into every flapping ear. Then you can join my crew. I am looking for good watchkeeping officers. Will you sign up with me, lad?
Wilson smiled almost shyly.
I have heard of you afore, Captain, he said. You see, my uncle sailed with your father aboard the Lady Edwina, and with you on the Golden Bough. He told tales of you.
Who was your uncle?
Ned Tyler, Captain, and he still is.
Ned Tyler!
Hal exclaimed. He'd not heard that name in 5 years.
Where is he?
On his farm near Bristol. He bought it with the prize money he won on board your ship, Captain. Ned Tyler was one of the best men Hal had ever sailed with, and he marvelled yet again at how small and close-knit was the Brotherhood of the Sea.
So what do you say then, Wilson? Will you sign the watch bill on the Seraph?
I would like it well to sail with you, Captain.
Hal felt a lift of pleasure at his acceptance.
Tell my bosun, Daniel Fisher, to find lodgings for you until we can move into our quarters on the ship. Then you can exercise your penmanship by composing a letter to your Uncle Ned. Tell him to stop milking cows and shovelling muck, and get on his sea boots again. I need him.
After Wilson had clumped down the narrow wooden stairs to the parlour below, Hal moved to the small window that overlooked the cobbled stable yard. He stood there, hands clasped behind his back, and watched Aberley instruct the twins with the blade. Guy sat on a pile of hay, with Dorian next to him. He must have finished his turn, for he was red in the face and sweating in dark patches through his shirt. Dorian was patting his back in congratulation. Hal watched while Aberley exercised Tom in the manual of arms, the six parries, and the full repertoire of cuts and thrusts. Tom was sweating lightly when at last Aberley faced him and nodded to begin the bout.
On guard, Klebe!
They fought half a dozen inconclusive engagements. Hal could see that Aberley was moderating his power to match Tom, but the boy was tiring and slowing down when Aberley called to him,
Last one, Klebe. This time I mean to hit you.
Tom's expression hardened, and he went on guard in khat, point high, watching Aberley's dark eyes to read his move before he launched.